Now, welcome to another inspiring edition of Sound Insight with Dr. Tom Curran.
Well, good morning and welcome to the program. This is Dr. Tom Curran. It's great to be with you. And today I've got something that I've been waiting to talk about and interested in talking about, but didn't know how to talk about for several years. And that theme is Bitcoin. Yes, that's right. Some of you might be thinking, is this a new theological doctrine? Is that a Greek word? No, it is not. But there are theological implications to how we understand money. And today on the program, I have the wonderful pleasure and the gift of talking to Eric Sammons. He's an author of a book called Moral Money, which is unfolding the case for Bitcoin. And you're going to be fascinated by this. I know you are. And you're going to learn some things actually about me and how I've been relating to the reality of Bitcoin in my life as well in the last handful of years. All right, back in a minute with Eric Sammons.
Hey, this is Dr. Tom Curran, the host of Sound Insight, but also a realtor serving wonderful folks like you in the state of Washington and in Idaho. I've had the privilege and pleasure of helping dozens of families in the last 2.5 years discern and find a strategy, a path, and a plan to help their families find a whole new life in Eastern Washington and Northern Idaho. If I could be of service to you in that, I would love to. Please reach out, drtomcurran.com, drtomcurran.com.
Hey, welcome back to the program. This is Tom Curran. And I want to say a prayer, and then I'm going to immediately bring on Eric Sammons to talk about his new book, Moral Money. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Lord, our God, we thank you and praise you for the gift of this day and for this new month. And Lord, I just pray that this would be a new beginning for us, that we would enter into this month and this season of our lives with a sensitivity to your Holy Spirit. Lord, just give us insight and wisdom to know what it is you ask of us, and give us the grace to do it, to follow your will fully and quickly. And we make this prayer in Jesus' holy name. Amen. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Well, I want to welcome to the program Eric Sammons. Eric is the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. He is a convert to the Catholic faith. He has a degree not only in theology, a master's degree in theology, but a degree in finance, economics. And I'm like, wow, this... And he wrote a book, right? And this is why he's here. This is why I get the privilege of being able to talk to him, is because of his new book on Bitcoin, which is called Moral Money, The Case for Bitcoin. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. So I just want to just start and say, hey, thank you for doing this, because I mentioned at the in my introduction to the program that I have been wanting to talk about Bitcoin. I've maybe just the most gentle and like nuanced way just mentioned it in the last couple of years on my radio program, but I didn't know how to talk about it easily and well. And then when a dear friend of both of ours, Susie Abel, said, hey, did you hear about this book that Eric Sammons is writing? And then I'm like, oh my goodness, I have to have Eric on. So Eric, first of all, Moral Money. All right, where do we even want to start on, like, what would move you to want to write a book like that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And really, it started with, the genesis of this book started before Bitcoin was even invented. Years ago, I was studying economics. I was studying my Catholic faith. I was studying what the church teaches about money, about finance, about economics, and all of that. And I really came to the conclusion that our modern system of money is deeply immoral. I'm not the only person who came to this conclusion. Since then, I've read a number of other writers, Catholic writers, and even Christian writers who aren't Catholic, talk about the immorality of our current monetary system. And for me, I was like, that's a real problem. It reminded me a little bit of what John Paul II talked about a lot during his pontificate, which was the structures of sin. And he would refer, for example, to the culture of death, to abortion, euthanasia, things like that, where he's not denying or diminishing the reality of our personal moral agency, that if a person procures an abortion, for example, that is a sin that is on them. They have to deal with it. But at the same time, because of the pervasiveness of something like abortion and how it's supported by so many governments and the culture and society, that there's this structure of sin that we all participate in some way. For example, we all pay, if you're American, you pay taxes, and your taxes goes to fund Planned Parenthood. And so you are, sadly enough, in some way paying for abortions. Now, I'm not talking about the personal moral culpability you have for things like that, but I'm just saying that we're all involved in it. And Pope John Paul decried that. And I started to see that our monetary system is really one of those structures of sin that we all participate in. We can't help it. I mean, I got to buy groceries. I have to buy clothes. I mean, I have to use our money in order to survive. But yet that monetary system is very immoral. And that's really got me started. And so I this was like in the early 2000s, so about 20 years ago.
Well, and Eric,
so.
I'm just going to I wanted to say, okay, you used a phrase, monetary system. And there's some people thinking, a lot of folks out here saying, all right, I think I know what he means. But just to keep it as simple as possible, what is a monetary system versus, oh, I get paid money and I spend money? What is a monetary system?
Yeah, that's a great question. A monetary system, and the truth is, throughout this interview, it probably happened a lot where we're using terms and concepts that people don't think about very much. And so I know it's a high hurdle. I recognize that. I've been studying this for over 20 some years. So I get that people who are being introduced to this, it's a high hurdle. But when I say monetary system, I honestly just mean the form of money that we use. So for example, in America, we use dollars that are backed by and created by the U.S. government. Maybe 150 years ago, we might have been under a monetary system called the gold standard, meaning gold was the main form of money, and then paper was used or coins were used to represent gold. 1,000 years ago, it might have been a straight gold system and silver, where every time you pay, the money you use was actual real gold and real silver. The monetary system, therefore, is just simply the form of money that is the dominant form in a culture, a society, in a country. And so for us, it's simply the U.S. dollar, which is 100% backed by the U.S. government and created by the U.S. government. That's our monetary system.
Well, and Eric, you're going to use the phrase, I know, during our interview, and it's in your book, Moral Money, the fiat system, right? And that's it's differentiated from, for instance, money backed by gold. So, but what is you're going to talk about the fact that we're living in a fiat monetary system. And what does that mean? And fiat sounds good. That's like there's Latin right there. Let it be done to me, right? Let's go.
Yeah, I know. When you hear fiat system, a Catholic should naturally be, hey, that sounds pretty good to me, because obviously we know about Our Lady's fiat, where she told the Archangel Gabriel, let it be done unto me according to God's will. But what we mean by fiat here is just the Latin phrase meaning let it be done, meaning let it be. And this, in this scenario, what we mean is the government basically saying, okay, let there be money. Let there be created money. So it's fiat money. It's 100% simply created by government mandate. That's in contrast to two other different forms, types of money, one of which is Bitcoin, which we can talk about in a minute. But the other type is what I just call like natural money, or money that's kind of governed by physics. So something like gold, you can't create gold out of thin air. You have to spend time and energy and money in order to mine it out of the ground. Maybe one day we'll be mining it from asteroids. But the point is, all other forms of money before fiat were natural forms of money. So seashells were used as money. Copper has been used as money. Gold and silver we know about. There's been lots of different stones have been used, just regular stones have been used as money. Those are all natural forms in the sense that they come from nature. You can't create them out of nothing. Fiat money is money that's literally created out of nothing. A government official just simply hits a button these days and says, okay, now there's more money in the system. Yes, I know it's a little more complicated than that, but essentially that's what happens with fiat money.
Well, and this is the thing, Eric. I think one of the things that happens is folks, when they hear Bitcoin and they start like making that journey, and it raises the question, what is money, right? What is money? And when I think about it, it's like, okay, it's backed by the fate, like that $10 bill that I have. Why is that worth anything? Oh, the government says it's worth something, and everyone is in an agreement that it's worth something. And so now we can actually operate in a system where everybody's in agreement because of the government that these dollars that are this cash is actually worth something, but there's nothing backing it up. There's nothing that backs up that system. So in the end, one of the things that you're going to bring up one of the things you bring up in this book is that this current system that we're in that involves our dollars, folks, and the printing of money by the government, it's not morally neutral. It's not just a way of organizing the exchange of goods. No, there's actually a moral quality and the ability to evaluate the system itself as potentially involving what you identified in John Paul II, a structure of sin. So please, I'll let you continue, because I know that you've identified a number of ways in which the current system of how we exchange goods and utilize money as part of that is flawed and has profound moral negatives associated with it. Talk about that.
Yeah, so most people think of the monetary system they live under as morally neutral. It's kind of like the weather. It just is what it is. You can't really control it. And so most of us haven't really thought about, like, where does money come from? What is money? And if you look at the history of money, what you see is money essentially develops organically throughout history, in the sense that people decide, you know, it'd be more efficient if we had some good that we could just all agree has value for whatever reason, instead of me saying, okay, I have oranges and I want bananas. Let me trade you my oranges for your bananas. Oh, now I have some bananas, but what I really need now is I need a house. So I need to sell all my oranges for a house. It just doesn't practically work. And so what happened was, just organically, again, this wasn't some government official said to do this, or king or ruler, but people just started saying, hey, this thing, this good, we all kind of think this is worth something. We all give it value. Let's use that. And I'll give you some pieces of silver for your apples. I will sell you my oranges for some silver, and then I'll save up the silver to buy a house or a cart or whatever the case may be. So we find that in history, certain things are given this value as that everybody agrees to. And so that becomes a medium of exchange, meaning people use it to exchange goods a lot more efficiently. And so, like I said, though, over history, it's just simply been everybody kind of come to this agreement organically. Gold, they all think it has good properties that is valuable, silver, whatever the case may be. But with fiat money, with the dollar, what happened was is that basically they said, the government said, okay, we're going to say this money has value. You have to accept it. You have to use it. And so people said, okay, I'll go along with that. But it's 100% dependent upon the government. And what we've seen is over time, every fiat money so far eventually ends up becoming equal to zero in its lifespan. Now, of course, the dollar, that hasn't happened to yet, because America is the most powerful country in the world. It's been able to maintain this. But I have actually sitting on the desk next to me a 1 million Zimbabwe dollar bill. And somebody gave it to me as a gift, and just kind of represent that this is what fiat money ends up becoming, because when governments start to crumble and go under, the money that they created becomes worth nothing. So literally, you go in the morning to buy a loaf of bread, it's $10. You go in later in the day and it's $150 or something like that, because the money's just devaluing as the government can't back it anymore. And so that right there is obviously a pretty clear immoral situation. But there's a lot of different factors that make a money moral or immoral, the money itself. And so if you want, I can kind of break down a few of them here. I think it might be helpful for
yeah,
the
please.
Listeners.
No, absolutely. Yes. I know that. Yeah. When you identify, like, you evaluated our current system of money and how fiat money has these series of negatives. And so please, yeah, talk about those.
So economists basically give money, things that become money, they have certain properties. That's how they became money. So they might be divisible, meaning you can spend a very small amount or a very large amount. It's portable. You can easily move it around. It's durable. It's fungible. Fungible is just a term meaning one unit of it's worth the same as another unit of it. In other words, an ounce of gold is worth an ounce of gold. No matter what form it's in, it's worth an ounce of gold. Those are some properties of money. But then there's also some other properties, scarcity, and I'll get into these in a second, scarcity, verifiability, and independence. What I've noticed is most economists, when they talk about the different properties of money, they just kind of lump them together. But really, there's two categories here. The first one, the first four I mentioned, like divisibility, portability, durability, fungibility, those are usefulness categories, meaning this money is useful. I can actually use it in transactions easily, or whatever the case may be. The other three, though, scarcity, independence, and verifiability, those are really moral qualities when you think about when it comes to money. So verifiability, for example, if a money could easily be counterfeited, it can easily be used. It basically encourages immoral behavior. And that's one thing I want to say when I talk about morality of money. Obviously, a piece of paper in itself is not moral or immoral. What I mean, though, is the system itself rewards immorality or it encourages immorality. That's really what I'm talking about when I say a money is immoral, is it rewards immorality or it encourages immorality. So something that is very easy to counterfeit, it's not very verifiable. Well, that's easy. That makes it easier to commit crime. It encourages immorality. So that's one moral property. Another one, this is a big one, is scarcity. And by that, what I mean is, how easy is it to create new money into the system? Because if I can easily, let's say I could create new money, like not counterfeit, but actually create gold, for example. Let's say I had the ability, you know, like they used to do in the medieval times, the alchemy, trying to make something into gold. What if you really could create gold, real gold, very easily? Like you could just take lead and turn it to gold. Well, that's a real moral problem too. It's similar to the counterfeiting problem, because people could just create new money. And when I create new money, here's the key that I don't think people don't always realize. When I create new money, I've actually devalued everybody else's money. Let me just explain that very quickly. Let's say you had a village of 100 people. Everybody had $100 in this village. Well, everything would be priced according to that fact, that everybody, 100 people have $100 in their bank account. In other words, if you went out and you said, okay, I want to sell this chair for $2,000, you're not going to get anybody to buy it, because nobody has more than $100. But now let's say you were able to create out of nothing $1,000 for yourself. Now you have $1,100. Everybody else has $100. Now if somebody says, I want to sell this chair, let's say they want to sell for $500 even, you can buy it. Nobody else can. So the price of the chairs just went up because you just added money to the system. That's a very basic explanation, but it kind of expresses that when more money gets into a system, into the monetary supply, meaning just how much money there is in the system, then prices go up. That's what inflation is. That's why it's called inflation, because actually people think inflation just means the price goes up. Inflation actually means you're inflating the money supply, making it bigger, and that means prices go up. So people who don't get that new money, that they get higher prices and no more money. So we see scarcity. In other words, the difficulty in creating new money, you can get new gold out of the ground, but it takes a lot of energy, a lot of money. So it's very difficult. So gold really is scarce. Silver is less scarce, but it still is. Copper is even less scarce. And you can tell by the cost of each of those, the one that's the most scarce is the most expensive. And so a real moral property of money is that it would be scarce, not easily. It's not easy to create new money. And then the last one, just real quickly, is independence. What I mean by that is, can somebody control the money supply? Can they control who makes money, who can't? Because if they can, they have a lot of power. And with a lot of power, we know, becomes very much a vector for immorality. You know, great power, the more likely you are to abuse it. And so what we see is, if a money is not independent, if it's dependent, what we see, and we've seen this in history with fiat money, governments then create it for their own purposes. So for example, let's say a government official wants to get elected. So he promises new social programs that he can just print money to support. Or let's say a leader wants to start a very unpopular war, a war his people do not support. Well, traditionally he would have to tax them, and they just might say, no, we're not going to pay those taxes for this war. Well, if he can just create new money, i.e. the money is not independent, well, then he can just create new money and fund the war without the support of his people. And we've seen this in history, because if you look at the history of warfare, for example, it has radically changed in the last 100, 150 years with the introduction of widespread fiat currency, because government officials aren't beholden to their people in order to start new wars, because they can just fund it by printing brand new money. So that's I know it's very short, very quick, but that's an overview of some of the moral aspects of money. Now, it impacts our daily lives a lot, but that's kind of the overview of the moral aspects of money.
Hi, this is Dr. Tom Curran, and you know me as the host of Sound Insight. I am also letting folks know that as a realtor licensed in the state of Washington and in Idaho, I love serving Catholic families and others who are discerning a move for yourselves. It's much more than buying or selling a home. It's discerning a whole new life. If that's something that you would find a help in, if I could be of service to you, please be in touch. You can find out more at drtomcurran.com. drtomcurran.com.
I'm talking with Eric Sammons. Eric is the author of the book, Moral Money, The Case for Bitcoin. And folks, I know that for the great majority of you, Bitcoin has maybe a word you've only heard of now and again, but haven't really thought much about. What Eric does in his book is he makes a case for the evaluation of Bitcoin based on Catholic Church teaching, natural law, that it is a sound money. It is a moral form of money than the current system of money that involves the U.S. dollar. One of the things that you said in the book that really jumped out at me, and I've done a lot of reading about Bitcoin, is you associated fiat money with inflation through inflation. That it not only erodes purchasing power, but it violates the seventh commandment. It's a form of stealing. And I haven't heard anybody make that case yet. You shall not steal. That was really striking to me.
Yeah, it really does violate that. And by what I mean is this. The church has talked a lot in our social teaching about, for example, this is just one example of like just wage. The idea that an employer should pay an employee a just wage. Now, there's a lot of debate on exactly how you define a just wage, what is a just wage, exactly things like that. But even let's take a step aside from that. Let's say you have a lower middle class dad supporting his family, and he's got a job. He's a hard worker. He's getting paid a just wage. He can support his family with it, but it's nothing extravagant. He does everything right, and he saves his money, and he saves his money like his grandfather saved his money, maybe in a can in his closet or under his mattress, or maybe just in a savings account at work. He's saving because he knows there might be a rainy day sometime. Maybe he gets injured and he can't work for a while, or maybe one of his family members has a medical emergency and he needs more funds than he has. So he saves his money like a good, honest Catholic would do to support his family. Well, meanwhile, the government is printing money like crazy because they want to get elected again. They think they're trying to solve current economic problems. And now all of a sudden, let's say he saved $5,000. And he's been doing this for 10 years. Well, by the end of that 10 years, that money he saved, let's say he even got a $5,000 bonus one day and he just saved it for 5 years. Well, by the time that 10 years is up, that money in purchasing power is only worth maybe $4,000, $4,200, something like that. So where did that money go? He worked for $5,000. That was he took his energy, he took his time, he took his effort to make $5,000 honestly and fairly. However, he held on for 10 years, and now all of a sudden he can only purchase, let's say, $4,000 worth. And this is not an absurd number. I'm talking about, this is like very consonant with real inflation numbers in our country, and they're worse in other countries. Well, what is that if not stealing? That you've taken $1,000 of his purchasing power away from him through no fault of his own and through no reason other than just some government officials decided we want to make more money in the system because it'll help us. And maybe it'll help people connected to us, help us get more votes and things like that. So to me, that is a real form of stealing, a violation of the commandment, thou shalt not steal. It takes the money away. In fact, John Paul II mentioned, I can't remember the encyclical, but he talks about, and it's mentioned in the catechism, about the need for a stable currency. In other words, the truth is we think the dollar's stable because things are priced in dollars. That's the only thing we know. But think about all the conversations you have, for example, with your mom, your grandmother, something like that, about how what milk used to cost. You know, milk used to cost, like, what was it? You know, $1 a gallon or something like that. Or I remember gas the best. And I remember when I was a kid, I'm old enough to remember when gas was under $1, when you could buy gas for 99 cents a gallon or 95 cents a gallon. Now, of course, it's over $3, in some places over $5. Well, why is that? It's not because gas got harder to make or milk was harder to produce or anything like that. It's simply because the value of the dollar went down. And that's what I mean by purchasing power goes down. So to me, that is a real moral issue, that you have a situation in which people's hard-earned money is getting stolen from them by their declining purchasing power. Because remember, That's what money represents. When you say you you're worth $1 million, let's say you're fortunate, you're worth $1 million. That $1 million is meaningless if you don't know what it can purchase. What if what if you live in Zimbabwe and you're talking about $1 million Zimbabwe dollars, you know, a number of years ago, that would have got you maybe a soda. Whereas in America, $1 million can purchase you a very, very nice house in American dollars. So the point is purchasing power is what matters when it comes to the value of money. And if you take that purchasing power away, you're stealing from the person.
Yeah, Eric. Yeah. What you're saying is so important. And again, it's folks, I know this isn't a typical topic for us to talk about on this program, but this is Catholic social teaching as it applies to your concrete day-to-day life. And for me, it's one of those things where a clarion call is needed, a desperate cry to say, pay attention, like focus for a moment, not just on your bank account, but on the nature of the monetary system that we're in. I think in the news today, there's a lot of talk about the rising national debt, how it's over 36 trillion, headed to 37 trillion, how the government doesn't know how to operate within a budget that is that's balanced. And so we're going to go into debt another $1.5 trillion in this next budget. And sure enough, we're going to have to print money in order to be able to cover the cost of even paying off the interest on the debt and, you know, all these other factors that are in here that just for most people, they're like, I just want to live my day-to-day life. I just want to work my job. I want to live my life. And all these big things that are just happening at a realm that's just so much bigger than me, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around it. But to strip it all down and say, your money that you're making right now, the amount that you're going to make next year is probably not going to go up as much as the cost of the goods. So inflation is going to outpace how much money you make. Your purchasing power is going down. And that's not just because of the job you have. It's because of the system you're in. And you know what? It's bad now, and it's going to get worse. And so in your book, Eric, Moral Money, The Case for Bitcoin, you raise an alternative, not just money, but system of money. And so I want to shift to that because we've talked a bit about the current circumstances and the sort of the philosophy of money. But let's just start off with the word Bitcoin. I remember someone said to me, yeah, I like having Bitcoin rather than some other cryptocurrency because it's at least a coin. It's something I can hold in my hand. And I'm like, I don't think you know what Bitcoin is. So, Eric, again, in the simplest terms, can you help explain to us, have a little conversation here, what is Bitcoin?
Yeah, that's great. And I love the fact in this conversation, we've gone, what is it, maybe half an hour or something like that, and we haven't even talked about Bitcoin and the whole conversation is about Bitcoin, because the truth is you need to set the table like we did. I mean, the questions you ask at first are perfect because we need to understand money and our current system to understand Bitcoin. So I like to think Bitcoin, first of all, it's not what you think it is. almost everybody listening, it probably isn't what you think it is. It's not some crazy investment. It's not some speculative force. It's not like Beanie Babies or anything like that. It's not some
not a pyramid scheme.
not a pyramid scheme. It's not something used just to buy drugs on the internet or something like that. Ultimately, all Bitcoin is just another form of money. Like I mentioned in the past, we've had various forms of money in our history. Seashells have been used. Rocks have been used. Copper, silver, gold have been used. Paper now and digital fiat money has been used. Bitcoin is simply a new form of money. And so that's the first thing you have to remember is always come back to that. And in fact, that's what distinguishes it from all the other cryptocurrencies. There's hundreds of thousands, millions of other cryptocurrencies. They're not really forms of money. Bitcoin is a form of money. And so by saying it's a form of money, I simply mean it has the properties, those seven properties I talked about earlier, of money. And so it can be used as money. And people have begun to value it as a form of money. Now, here's the key thing that I think trips up so many people today, and particularly, and I'll say this because I'm one of them, older people. I don't mind saying that because I'm a little bit older. And that is, it's a form of money that resides 100% on the internet. There is no physical form of Bitcoin. I mean, even on the cover of my book, I have a coin, a picture of a coin with a B on it, the Bitcoin symbol on it. And I was a little bit nervous about doing that because I was like, oh no, people are going to think it's a physical coin. That's just a physical representation on an image. There is no physical form of Bitcoin. 100% resides on the internet. So But it was created in such a way that it would have these forms, these properties of money, so it could be used as money. So really, when we get down to it, that's what it is. It's just a form of money. And so think about maybe...
Well, can I say this, Eric?
Yeah,
let me
ahead.
Give you an example. Let me see if this works. So folks, Bitcoin is digital money. That's what it is. And if I said to you, think in your lifetime, in the last 40 or 50 years, with the rise of the internet, and now the internet is an entire world. So the digital world, we have what's called digital transformation. And so there are so many parts of our lives that have been transformed from the physical world into the digital world. I think the easiest one for folks my age and in your age, I think you're a little younger than I am, is music, right? So when I was at the beginning of my music life, it was what? It was an LP or it was a 44, right? So these little albums, and then it went to 8-track, and then it went to cassette, and then it went to CDs, and then it went to MP3s, but MP3s somehow were mostly living online. And if I wanted to access music apart from the physical, I had to go turn on a radio and I could go and look around different stations, and hopefully this song would come on when I wanted it. Right. So that was our world. We had to go buy an album, something physical, get a physical machine to play it, and in order to enjoy it. And now that world doesn't, I mean, it only exists as like a hobby now. Or a retro thing, right? And now music is, oh, you can go to Spotify or a dozen other platforms and you can listen to any song in human history almost immediately, almost always for free. And you can start it, stop it when you want and move around. That's digital transformation, folks. What started in the physical world has moved into the digital world. And there are, we could spend a long time identifying all of these different aspects of life that started in the real world, like a map in the car, right? Did you start off where you had that big map and you had to open it up? And it
was, oh yeah, absolutely.
8, 7, and there's the road, and that's where we want to end up. And then trying to figure it out. And now people, or phone numbers, right? Do you know people's phone numbers? No, I just know a contact. I just click on it. Everything moves into the digital realm, and so does money. And so money is moving into the digital realm. Go ahead, Eric. You want to jump in?
I was just going to say, one of the things that's unique about Bitcoin is it's both an advancement and a return. It's that move. It's exactly what you just said about the moving to the digital world. And so it is very much moving to the digital world in that the currency here is native to the digital world. The funny thing about, of course, fiat currency is people think that like when they spend money online, it's representing like paper dollars or coins in a bank. It's actually not. It's 100% on a database somewhere in some bank. And so it really is. And it's just 100% just you trust that because the government tells you to trust it. Bitcoin, though, whereas it takes those that property of like digital money that it resides 100% on the internet, it's actually a return, though, in a lot of ways to the properties of physical money, of gold itself. That's really what the genius of Bitcoin is that, remember how I was talking about the categories of the properties of money? You have the usefulness, you have the morality. Well, fiat money is very useful. It's very efficient. You can spend it very easily. In fact, that's why they did that. They want you to spend it very easily, but it's not very moral. Gold is very moral, but in today's economy, today's world, it's not very useful. It's very difficult. If you want to get something at Amazon, good luck if you have an ounce of gold buying a book at Amazon with that ounce of gold. It just simply, you're going to have to sell the ounce of gold. So you have to go somewhere, sell it. I mean, it's not going to happen. Well, what Bitcoin does is it marries those two things. It takes the efficiency of our current monetary system of fiat money, and it marries it to that moral properties of gold, where it has the scarcity, it has the verifiability, and it has the independence. And so really, it's kind of like this unique creation where it goes back in time for some properties, but yet it advances further in the ability to spend it online. In fact, Bitcoin is very much more efficient to spend online than money is. If you don't realize that when you like spend your credit card online, it actually takes about a couple months, at least a month, sometimes a couple months before that transaction is actually resolved at every bank involved in the process. And it goes through a lot of steps to make that happen. If I send you Bitcoin in 10 minutes, you got it. And I can't get back. You can't, you know, you have it 100%. It's 100% yours. And there's no, you know, that's how efficient it is. So, and it costs a lot less than if you spent, for example, if I had $1 billion worth of gold, well, might not be on this podcast if that was the case, but it'd be very difficult to send it to you. Even seeing $1 billion in cash, like in fiat money, you got to get so many approvals and regulations, stuff like that. I can send $1 billion in Bitcoin in 10 minutes, just like I could if I wanted to spend $10 of Bitcoin. So it's like what you said, it's a digital transformation, but I know Catholics, rightly so, get a little nervous about that. And there's aspects of it I don't like either. I think there's aspects of that, of moving away from the real, from the physical, that I think we should be concerned about with as Catholics. I'm not like this 100% let's go live in the metaverse or whatever, something like that. Mm-hmm. Yet what Bitcoin does that I think is beautiful is, although it resides 100% on the internet, it took those properties of old school money, like gold, like silver, and it went, that's what Bitcoin has as well.
You know, Eric, so it's great. So if we say it's digital money, then you improved it by saying it's actually digital gold. Right? Yes. But it's a better version of gold than gold is, and because it's residing in this digital setting. All right, back in a minute with Eric Sammons. I'm talking with Eric Sammons. Eric is the author of the book, Moral Money, The Case for Bitcoin. And folks, I want you to think about it. You might think that your concept of money is principally involved in cash. I want to say to you, probably the great majority of your transactions are all digital. They involve credit cards and debit cards and online clicking of buttons. Even your bank accounts are not, I'm going to get out of the bank and go look at the cash that's in the safe. No, it's all just online. And I have, you think about the level of challenges that you have, the permissions and the policies and the rules around accessing and using your own money. It's actually quite frustrating. Once you've experienced Bitcoin and being on the Bitcoin network, right? When you're in this network where you can actually exchange money for goods online in this network, It's so freeing because it's decentralized. It's permissionless. It doesn't require someone to authorize my transaction. And so there are so many aspects of saying, okay, if I want to get into Bitcoin, what does that actually mean for the use of my money? And I think that actually tees up a little bit the different uses of money, right? As a store of value, as a medium of exchange, as a unit of account, or even down bottom as a collectible. I'm not sure where you want to go next with this, but I threw a whole bunch at you there. And I would say, what do you want to hit next here?
I think something you said, I think people don't realize they need to realize. If you have money at the bank or an investment account or something like that, you actually don't own it, not in a real true sense of actually owning it. Like if you have gold in a safe at your house, you own it. It's yours. It's 100% under your control. If you have money at a bank, that is not true. And there have been examples in recent history where people with money at a bank all of a sudden realize that. One example is about a dozen years ago or so in Greece when they had a financial crisis. They decided literally, the government decided literally to what they called a haircut. They basically took, I think it was like 10%, of cash out of people's accounts at their banks who had net worth over $100,000, something like that. I can't remember what the exact numbers were. The point is that they literally just took it out of your account. And they said, okay, we're taking this because we need it for this financial crisis. You had no way to stop them from doing that if your money was at the bank. Likewise, just a couple years ago, I think most people know about the Canadian trucker protest up in Canada. And what happened was, and they were protesting a lot of the regulations related to COVID and whatnot. And it was a completely legal protest. That's the important part to note. And yet what happened was the government wanted to shut it down and people were donating to their cause, to these truckers. And so they basically just shut down their bank accounts and took the money back from them. I mean, this was money for them. And I will say this, a little thing I'll let you know is I actually donated to Canadian trucker protest, but I donated in Bitcoin. And so I know they got it and they couldn't get taken away from them. But yet everybody else who donated to them, your money was just taken and used by the government. And so those are examples. Even if you don't even support like the Canadian trucker protests, you should understand how this can be abused so easily. I mean, as Catholics, we should know from our history that governments aren't always on our side. And so it could very well become a time in the not too distant future where the American government, for example, says, well, that guy's a Catholic and he said something publicly I don't really like. We're going to freeze his accounts. I mean, nothing is more chilling. If you're a business owner or even if you're just a dad, can you think of something more chilling than saying, I'm going to freeze your accounts? How are you going to feed your family? How are you going to put food on the table? How are you going to make sure you pay your electric bill and things like that? And so I think that's something that very important. Remember that we've gotten used to the idea of that we trust a third party with our money, that we don't really have control over money. Well, Bitcoin changes that radically. It returns to that old paradigm of your money that you hold is actually your money that you hold. And so I think that alone gives it a certain value and gives it a certain power, a moral power, really, because now I am responsible for my own money, but also that means that nobody can just take it from me. Because honestly, I would argue that what the Canadian government did when they took the Canadian truckers' money, that's stealing. It just, and what the Greek government did when they just were like, well, we screwed up everything. We messed up how we run things. And now we're in these terrible deficits. We're in a terrible crisis. We're just going to take money off the top from everybody over who has a certain net worth. That's just stealing under another name. I mean, they're going to make it all sound like it sounds good, but it's just stealing. And so I think these are things that we have to consider. And that's why Bitcoin, I think, is a solution to those moral problems.
Again, this is Eric Sammons. Eric has a book published by Sophia Press. It's just come out. It's a new book. You can get it. Go to Sophia Institute Press. You'll find it right there on their homepage. It's called Moral Money, The Case for Bitcoin. And Eric is talking about Bitcoin. And I'm guessing, again, folks, this is something that's somewhat new for you. When I first got interested in Bitcoin, my brother told me about it in 2018. I ignored him. 2020 with the COVID crisis, my wife was like, I don't know, this whole stock market thing is crashing. What's going on in this world? So we started looking into Bitcoin. We studied it for several months. And then decided, you know what, we want to take some portion of our net worth, we want to put it into Bitcoin. And that was in the fall of 2020. And the interesting thing was the bank wouldn't let me. My bank, a credit union here in the state of Washington, would refuse to wire my money to Coinbase. They wouldn't let me do it. They said, no, we don't recognize them as an authentic third party to receive your money. And so I had to get an intermediary bank that was a digital, like online bank, to receive the money in order to get it into one of the largest, cryptocurrency platforms in the world. And that was in 2020. And then even 2 months ago, I wanted to shift some money around in my retirement account that is held in one of the largest brokerages in the country. And they wouldn't let me do it unless they sent in the mail a form that I had to fill out. I had to go to a bank, get it notarized, and then I had to send it to them. And so that whole process took me 2 weeks to be able to move, not even a huge amount of money, but to be able to do that, I had to jump over all of these hurdles. And then the last one is we support some folks in Zaire. And I went to one of the largest, money sending organizations in the world. And they made us go through all kinds of hoops, pictures of them and me and accounts. And do you know them? Look in the camera, take your pictures, fill out these affidavits. And it was shot. And then how much money it cost, the amount of money it cost so that I could send a small donation to help these folks in an African country. This is shocking. This is like crazy. And yet we just live with it.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, because it is your money. Now, arguments for it would say, oh, well, we do this to try to stop crime and things like that. The truth is, crime goes on with no problem. And the dollar is the most used in cash. In fact, it is the most used way in criminals operate. They can easily get around any of these things. All it really does is it just keeps honest citizens like us from actually accessing our own money and spending our own money. I mean, definitely countries outside, less developed countries, they're the ones who can benefit the most, frankly, from a system like Bitcoin, because exactly what you said, it's so difficult to get the money. Their money is always devalued much more than the American. I mean, we complain, and rightly so, when our money goes down by 10% in a year, but theirs might go down 50%, 100% in a year. I mean, it's just unbelievable how quickly the value of their currency can change. That's why they love something like Bitcoin. And I think this is like, this is really the use case, I would say, for Bitcoin is just simply, some people call it freedom money. And I think that's a good way to put it, where you work hard, you earn your money, it's your money to do with what you want. And like the idea, we're not saying like, this isn't greed. This is simply a matter of, I work for this money so I could support my family, so I could support missionaries, so I could support the church. So it's just simply a matter of using this money to help follow the call of the Lord. Well, when all of a sudden that's taken away from you and your ability to really to use that money, that's a real problem. That's why having a freedom money like Bitcoin is a great way to do it. And I know many stories like yours, and they're just ridiculous, about where you want to send money from your bank to like a cryptocurrency exchange and they just won't allow it. Now, I do think that's changed a lot with the election of President Trump, because his administration has endorsed a lot of these Bitcoin and these exchanges and stuff. So I don't think it would happen as much now. But I mean, 2020 wasn't that long ago, and maybe another administration would make it worse in the future. I don't know. But Bitcoin, by getting out of the fiat system, so to speak, as much as you can't get out of it completely, obviously, it really does give you a certain freedom. Like I can, and I've done this before, where somebody needs, support, like overseas or something like that, I can just send them Bitcoin. And nobody can tell me I can't do it. Maybe there's somebody who's under a government that would not allow them. I mean, maybe it's like, you know, a Christian in a Muslim-dominated country or something like that. I can just send them money. I can send them Bitcoin, and they can take care of it. I don't need to get permission from anti-Catholic forces in order to make it happen.
Again, I'm talking with Eric Sammons. Please, I want you to look up his book, Moral Money, The Case for Bitcoin. It's Sophia Institute Press. It's an important book. And I want to say it's an important book for you. Even if you never send money overseas, even if you're not concerned about the ability to access your money and move it around, the system we're in, it's on shaky ground. And this is not financial advice, but I've talked to friends about this for 5 years, and it is a hard sell. You're wearing an orange tie as we do this video, and that's a symbolic for, it's called being orange-pilled, where it's a change of mindset, which is the deepest form of conversion. But I feel like there's a lot at stake in this. What your book is doing is, your book is providing a basis that is a Catholic evaluation from a moral standpoint, from the church's teaching standpoint, how this not only is in alignment with church teaching, it's a better form of money in accord with church teaching. But even apart from that, there's a lot at stake right now in making wise decisions financially for yourself, for your family, and for the next generation to come. Like, how much is that part of your perspective? Because this is a huge deal for me with my kids. You've got 7 kids, I've got 9 kids. And I've been talking to my kids about Bitcoin for years to get them to think about it, to ponder it, to understand the nature of money, to understand the concept of inflation and of just the idea of the loss of the value of the money that they're making. And there's just a ton at stake in this for the baby boomer generation and then the generation to come. And you do touch on this in your book. So please talk about that.
Yeah, I think this is where it really gets kind of more real for me. It is like seeing, like I have some of my children now grown, and they've graduated from college, getting married. One just had my first grandchild. So I'm seeing the real life case, their monetary situation, the struggles they have. They're all good people working hard, but the financial struggles they have. And so I have talked about Bitcoin ever since I've gotten involved with it, first in 2013, so a very long time ago. But here's the key that I think people need to know. Bitcoin is not a get-rich-quick scheme. It is a save-over-time scheme. That's a big difference. It's not a get-rich-quick scheme. It's a save-over-time scheme. If you look at, for example, a lot of the other cryptocurrencies, they were actually created as get-rich-quick schemes, frankly. And not all of them, but a lot of them are. Bitcoin was not created like that. Now, I'm not saying people haven't gotten rich from it. People got in very early, like in 2010, 2011, and they put a lot into it. Like, heck, I'll be honest. I wish I had put everything into it in 2013. I didn't fully understand it when I first got involved. In fact, right. I have in my life spent more Bitcoin than I own, a lot more. I've spent probably more than 30 Bitcoin in my life, because early on, I was just using it, spending it and all that. I didn't really fully grasp what it was, but I have over time. So I'm not saying people haven't gotten rich off it. But what I am saying is that it's really the way it's designed, it's to hold value more than anything else. Just like gold holds value over time, Bitcoin holds value. Yes, it goes up and down in the short term. In fact, this is something I tell people when they first get started in Bitcoin, they're like, oh, how do I get started? I always say to them, buy a little bit, just hold, buy it at like, you know, River or Coinbase, something like that, and just hold it, because you need to get used to how it goes up and down. Because what will happen is, let's say you go out and buy $100 worth of Bitcoin today. There is a decent chance in a week it's worth only $85 or $90. That will happen. In fact, I joke with my wife, whenever I buy a little Bitcoin, I always say, well, I know the price is going down tomorrow because I just bought some. And that's just the way it is. You have to be able to understand that's what happens. But what I always say is, if you look at the history of Bitcoin, and I think, you know, they always say, and this is not investment advice, obviously, you know, past performance does not, you know, mean future results or anything like that. And that's true. But Bitcoin has been pretty consistent in how it operates. It operates on these cycles. And I won't get into technical details of why. The point, though, is if you hold Bitcoin for over 4 years, there's a basically a 100% chance, at least historically speaking, that your Bitcoin's worth more than when you bought it. And that means it's holding its value. A lot of times it's worth a lot more, which is great. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But really what it's doing is it's allowing you to still maintain that purchasing power, that if you had just kept it in a savings account or under your mattress or in a tin can in your closet, you would have lost purchasing power. If you held Bitcoin, you would have gained, you would have kept it at the very least and likely gained purchasing power. So that's really, but it's over time. I've been here, you know, for 12 years now, is it? Yeah, about 12 years now in Bitcoin. I have seen 200% gains in a very short period of time and 80% drops in a very short period of time. And so I've seen the value of Bitcoin go up and down a lot in the short term. And by short term, I mean anything under a few years. I just don't think in, like, I know there's traders who trade Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies daily and things that are looking at these charts and stuff like that. I don't look at it like that. I look at it like, okay, I want to hold this. I want to hold it for at least, you know, 5 to 10 years. Will it keep the value? Because the truth is, if I need money in a year, I actually won't put it into Bitcoin. I'll just hold it in a bank account because, you know, if it's anything less than a year, especially, I like, you know, in fact, we have we're planning to do some home remodeling soon, and the guy's not available to do it until the fall, and that's fine, but I'm not putting that, and I've already saved the money for it. So I have the money available, but it hasn't, you know, it's just sitting there. So I could put it into Bitcoin. I think that'd be a mistake, even though, yeah, it might go up in value. It could go down because I need it in 6 months, less than 6 months. I just put in a bank account, let it sit there, make a little interest and go on. But if I know, okay, this is money for retirement, I need something I can trust in long term. And I personally trust in Bitcoin more than any other savings vehicle in the long term, in the true long term. And so I think this is a real something for our young people, particularly because I think our young people are getting more and more disillusioned. And I'm afraid the ones who aren't maybe educated well or brought up well, they're blaming the wrong things. And that's why you see a big increase in the embrace of socialism among young people, which is literally the exact opposite answer. They understand the problem on some level that, hey, my purchasing power keeps going down. My wages aren't keeping up with the prices of everything else, but they don't understand why that's happening. And therefore they don't understand the solution isn't, okay, let's just do more of the same, because that's really what socialism is. Let's just go more into the problem rather than solving the problem. And so Bitcoin is that alternative for young people in particular to say, I'm going to just get out of this system, which is clearly broken, and I'm going to save in a vehicle that will last long term. And just lastly, I just want to make it clear, this isn't investment advice. I don't know your personality. I don't know your financial situation or anything like that. There are some personalities that would have a very difficult time holding on to Bitcoin because of its volatility still. I think long-term, like in 50 years or more, I think the value of Bitcoin will be very stable in the sense it won't go up and down a lot in the short term. It will just maintain, kind of like gold has done for historically. I think that's the ultimate what will happen to Bitcoin. But we're still early on. It's only 16 years old. It's going to have a lot of fluctuations. If you can't sleep at night because it went down 10% in a day, well, you need to sleep, so maybe you shouldn't do that. But you know, the point is, though, I personally think if you're willing to ride out those ups and downs, I think it's a good place to put some of your savings. Personally, this is my own personal belief. I think it's a good place. And like, I just thought about something you said about telling your kids and telling your friends. I think it was your brother or something. My sister I first told her about Bitcoin, I think 2015, and she just didn't listen to me, And I'm not going to be pushy about it because, again, everybody's different. And then finally, I think it was around 2020 or so, she finally was like, okay, I'll get into this. And it was funny because when it did well and stuff, she goes, Eric, why didn't you tell me about this before? I'm like, Beth, I told you about this in 2015. She's like, oh, yeah, never mind. So it is kind of funny how that happens.
Yeah, my brother, when he told me it was at 4,000, it's tough because it was at 1,000 when he got interested and finally told me at 4,000. He's like, I'm sorry, you might be a little late there. As it's at 105,000 or 107,000 right now. So,
right.
Well,
right.
Eric, I really appreciate you taking time today. I feel like we've just scratched the surface of moral money, the case for Bitcoin. And there's so much more to say. Maybe I can have you on again at another point. But again, please, really Sophia Institute Press is a great place for the book. You can get it on, I'm sure, all the major platforms where you can buy books. Or if you actually find a bookstore, go into the bookstore and get it.
Just real quick, if you want a signed copy of the book, you can go to my website, ericsammons.com. And you can use Bitcoin to buy it if you want to at my website.
Well, that's awesome. ericsammons.com. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.